Hello, Rick Moore.
Hi, Rick Moore. This is Hanukkah Castle.
Hanukkah, so great to meet you. I'm honored. Thanks for checking in. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for talking to me.
Where are you?
I live in Somerville.
Oh, so you're at home right now?
I am, yeah.
Excellent. Okay, what we have is a multimedia site that has a lot of traffic, and from time to time we are lucky enough to interview performers who are go up to Shailen Lu. Forgive my ignorance in asking some stupid questions. I'm going to try not to. I'm going to ask you about, you know, a little bit about you. I've read your whole biography and stuff, but I'll ask you questions about your background, and I also will ask you a little bit about the creative process, what your muse is, or maybe what your thoughts are. And then of course, I want you to promote anything you want to promote about your performance at the Shailen Lu.
Right.
Okay. All right. Do I have the right headset on is the question. I'm very nervous, so forgive me. Jeez. Oh, God. And it's Hanukkah Castle. No,
yep.
You said Castle.
That's right. Yeah. Okay. Just think the holiday and the building, Hanukkah
Castle. Okay. I just wanted to make sure. All right, and let me get my recorder started. Okay, file, new, hit the red button. 3, 2, 1. With MSO News Sports, I'm Rick Moore, and honored now to be talking with Hanukkah Castle, who will be a performer at the Shailen Lu on November 15. And Hanukkah, welcome to MSO, and boy, it's an honor to have you on.
Oh, it's great to be here, Rick. Thanks for having me.
You know, I've read your bio, and the thing that jumps out about me, and I have to ask you this, how does a young woman who was born in Oregon end up in winning a fiddling contest in Texas, of all places, end up at Berkeley, and then become, I don't know, a Scottish celebrity? Please fill in the blanks for me.
Well, actually, let me fix a couple of things. I was born in California, but I moved to Oregon when I was one.
Mm-hmm.
So raised in Oregon. And then actually, I didn't compete in Texas. Here's the other weird thing about the Texas fiddle scene. It's quite big in the Pacific Northwest. So I won some fiddle contests in Texas-style fiddling, but I won it in Oregon.
Okay.
So confusing, I know.
Let me interrupt there and ask you the early process. How did you get into that kind of fiddling? You know, maybe when you started as a youngster picking up music and you know, playing the fiddle and getting lessons and things like that?
Yeah, I started playing the instrument, the violin, when I was 8 years old. I played a little bit of classical violin for a couple years with a teacher who lived about an hour away. I'm from a really small town called Port Orford, Oregon, down on the Southern Oregon coast.
Mm-hmm.
And he moved away, and right about the same time, my parents and I saw an ad on television for a fiddle contest in Crescent City, California, which is about an hour and a half south of us.
Mm-hmm.
So we went to the contest. I was 10 years old, and there were all these kids competing, and I was kind of like, I had never seen anything like this, and I came in like second to last.
Oh, no.
But we were at the contest, and this woman competing in the adult division, her name is Carol Ann Wheeler, she was amazing, and she said something about a camp that she was running. So we signed up for her fiddle camp, a week-long fiddle camp, and then we ended up talking to her, and she became my fiddle teacher. She lived in Portland, Oregon, which is like 6 hours north of where I live.
Hmm.
So we would go up there for lessons, and right about the time I started taking from her, she was teaching me Texas-style fiddle and old-time fiddle, and right about that time, she had gotten into Scottish music. So she had kind of discovered it, and she'd met this great fiddle player named Alistair Fraser, and she just encouraged me to play Scottish music, and so I learned some tunes. I ended up winning a contest, and in New Hampshire, I flew to New Hampshire to the New Hampshire Highland Games when I was 14 years old. And I won a contest, and I got a scholarship to study with Alistair Fraser and Buddy McMaster, a great fiddle player from Cape Breton Island, Nova Scotia. And the workshop, the camp was on the Isle of Skye in Scotland.
Good heavens.
So I went over there, and I was just drawn by the community and the dance aspect. I think I was getting to a point where I didn't want to do as many contests anymore. And I just was really attracted to this kind of music and the whole culture surrounding it. So I slowly started switching over to mm-hmm. Scottish music.
You had to have had some strong support from family along the way, along with your mentors.
I did. Very strong support. My mom is a retired music teacher. She taught me piano, and she was actually my music teacher, first grade through fifth grade, mm-hmm. like general music teacher. And both of my parents, you know, they took me to fiddle contests, took me, to fiddle camps. And honestly, that first year I went to Scotland, I had the incredible support of my family, but also my little town of 1,000 people, it's called Port Orford, on the Oregon coast. I did a little concert, and the whole town, came out, and, basically I raised money to pay for my flight.
Wow. All right. Well, you know, Port Orford can claim you, but I think Cape Ann's going to claim you as well. Because you live close enough by, so that's pretty cool, even though you're still a world traveler. Now, tell me about the Berkeley experience, because as a math teacher, a science teacher, and just a general nerd, the two names that I know that jump out of me in the music world are, of course, Juilliard and Berkeley. So to go there in itself is quite an honor. But also to find the success there. What was that experience like, and maybe what did you learn additionally there?
Yeah, so I came to Berklee College of Music in 1996. I had actually met the chair of the string department at a camp a year earlier. His name is Matt Glazer. Mm-hmm. He's still at Berklee. He now runs the American Roots division there. And basically, I was drawn to Berklee because it was one of the few music schools in the United States that was offering a non-classical approach to playing music. So there was no vibe of trying to get into an orchestra, and because I didn't actually play, I had stopped playing classical music when I was 10 years old. So I came out here, came to Boston, and Berklee, I'd say that was one of the best 4 years of my life. Like that freshman year too that I was there, I just met so many incredible musicians. And then kind of mixed with learning all this great music during the day and Berklee's approach to teaching and just really trying to kind of set you up to be a professional musician. I had that during the day, and then every night I was going out to a Celtic fiddle concert because I lived in Boston.
All right,
and,
yep.
There were just so many great musicians playing in Boston, and I saw so many people that first year.
I've had a opportunity to talk to Livingston Taylor twice, and and then we've actually gone to his shows up in Rockport, and the thing that impresses me about him is that as a musician the field is so competitive, but he not only teaches at Berklee, but he also is willing to go out and help his students on the road. And I think that kind of sharing is an experience you can't get everywhere. So how did you get started professionally?
How did I get started professionally? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Yeah. I this whole thing about living in Boston, right away, my first or second year of Berklee, Matt Glazer, the chair, he ended up taking some string students to Club Passim in Harvard Square to play a concert. I think it was called String Madness or something. And so that was my first time at Passim, which has grown, which has become this huge thing in my life, this amazing, community and venue. And so I started right away then, and then there's also a bunch of sessions in Boston. I started playing, at pubs. I started leading Scottish and Irish sessions at pubs. And then right around the time I graduated, I got asked by an Irish-American singer named Kathy Ryan to tour with her. And so I think just word of mouth, someone in the Boston scene knew that I played Celtic-style fiddle, and she was friends with Kathy, and then she recommended me. And that's, I think, how the performing thing happens here. And I even do that these days now with former students. Someone will call me and ask me for a gig, and I can't do it, and I pass it on to someone else. Mm-hmm. And there's such a thriving scene in Boston. I think it's one, I always think about it, there's so many musicians, and maybe on paper someone would look at that and be like, oh, well, there's not going to be enough gigs because there's too many musicians. And I think it's actually the opposite. there's more gigs because there's so many musicians.
Oh, that's great
and
to hear.
There's a culture and of people going out to concerts in Massachusetts that is really, I've traveled a lot around the U.S. and it's very special.
Well, I think especially in this area as well, in Boston, we were in Ireland back in 2013. We stayed in Killarney, and every single night there was a performance somewhere at some pub or some hall or whatever, every single night. And I think that's catching on here. I think maybe post-pandemic has kicked in, and people are wanting to get that. And I want to now maybe shift to your music. You are a prolific composer, and I must say two things. It sounds like you're not afraid of anything. And secondly, you have a very infectious presence, very charismatic in your videos, your smile and your laughing, and that, and you sound like you're an upbeat person. So that brings me to my question. A lot of the Irish music that we listen to is kind of melancholy. It reflects on hard times in Ireland. And then there's the dance tunes and the lilts and the excitement. Mm-hmm. Do you sort of fuse that together in your compositions, or how do you deal with all of that?
I definitely fuse those things together. And also, I think that I do, yes, most of the time I am like laughing and smiling, but actually there's a lot of the music that I've composed and play that's not happy, actually, that it's like kind of like has that melancholy and mm-hmm. maybe nostalgic mm-hmm. kind of sound. And actually, the fun thing about this tour is that I usually perform in my band, which is a guitar and either a cello or a five-string fiddle, like a trio. But this tour, I'm actually doing a duo with this pianist, Dave Weisler, and we will be playing a lot of music that I've written on many of my last several albums, maybe for the past 10, 15 years. And some of that music, because it's the piano playing, is actually more of that melancholy mm-hmm. theme. I think this kind of rich, full sound with the piano and the fiddle. And I call them kind of these epic pop ballads.
Okay. Well, yeah, on your website, a sentence that just jumped out at me and hit me right in the face is, it says, Castle's latest album, Infinite Brightness, lyrically and poignantly captures a brightness that shines with sorrow-tinted joy. And that sounds absolutely philosophical to me.
Well, that album in particular, too, Infinite Brightness actually comes from a quote basically talking about just life after death. Mm-hmm. And there's actually several tunes on that album. This album was kind of created, like, you know, we recorded it in 2022, and there had been actually not even just because of COVID, but like several people in my life that had passed away from other things, and then also just all of the loss in general during COVID. So that album actually is kind of, there's a lot of death kind of circling around it. And I think there is a joy you can find in playing music when you are faced with something that brings tremendous amount of grief or sadness.
Well, I remember the poet laureate, the young poet laureate at one of the inaugurations who said at the end of it, if we could but see the light, if we could but be the light, and that's what that sentence sort of evoked in me. Tell me what your schedule is like, and then let's focus on what's coming up.
Yeah, what my schedule is like right now?
Yeah, well, sort of a summary of your travels, because what's coming up in the future, you know, let's say in 2025, you must have some things planned already.
Yeah, actually, I have a lot of camps. Like workshops on the horizon internationally in 2025. I'm going to be teaching in Denmark and in France and in Germany at a camp that I teach at every year. And so that's kind of taking up a big part of the spring and the summer. And then I have, I'll be playing a festival in Boston called Boston Celtic Music Fest in January. I'm really excited about.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, the thing that's just really fun right now is that there's these shows coming up in November with Dave and a double bill with two guitar players who actually play, that I play with frequently, Keith Murphy and Jan Falke. Keith plays in my regular band, and Jan and I have recorded an album together and have performed together. And they're going to be playing a lot of songs and double guitar stuff, and Dave and I will be playing a lot of my compositions, some of Dave's compositions, and we're very excited, actually, about this pairing.
It doesn't sound like you have a lot of downtime, and I'm wondering how you compose. In other words, when you're on the road, when you're doing or preparing, rehearsing or whatever, is it at that time that you can also create?
You know, I've actually been touring a little bit less in the past couple years than I did before because I have a 5-year-old.
Okay.
Yeah. And my husband is also a full-time professional musician. So I would say that when I'm touring, I actually do not compose. I kind of just take that time now, especially if I'm, like, on my own, you know, just to really, like, get into the tour vibe. And then I do end up having more time now at home. And obviously there's a lot of admin and everything that comes with being a professional musician, but I've been actually composing a lot of music the past couple months, partially because I have this list of tunes that I need to write. I offered a commission situation where you can donate money to an organization called Many Hopes that I've supported, that I've visited a home in Kenya that Many Hopes supports. And I basically started writing tunes. People could donate money to Many Hopes, and I would write them a tune. And I have a list of many tunes right now.
Oh, wow. Well, I've got to get out to more Irish pubs, especially in Boston, and I'm going to follow you from now on. I mean, it's just what a remarkable career, and I appreciate your taking the time. But what do we expect now when you go to the Shailen Lou? I'm guessing you've probably performed there before.
Yep. I've played at the Shailen Lou many times, and, in fact, I played right when they had built it. They were kind of like sounding the room for like different styles of music. And I came and was one of the artists playing like folk music because they're so good about having classical and jazz and like all these different genres. And so I was there right at the beginning playing, I don't remember what year that was. It was a long time ago, but I was just, I remember walking in and being like, this is the most beautiful venue I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, in the daytime, they have to shut the curtains so people look at the performers instead of the background. So
I know.
I guess one more question about that. When you perform in a venue like the Shailen Lou that's very intimate and has great sight lines and great acoustics, do you commiserate with the audience?
Like, do I end up talking with the audience?
Well, not talking with them, but maybe just telling a little bit about what's coming up next. You know, is there some oration between songs?
Yeah, definitely. And actually at any venue that I play, I think the tradition in this style of music is to tell stories about the songs. And especially because I wrote so many of these tunes, there's often a story that goes with the tune. And you're right, it is really fun, specifically at the Shailen Lou, like kind of telling those stories and being able to kind of see everyone and having this very big space and that also feels really intimate.
In your playlist, about how many songs should we expect to hear?
Well, it's going to be a double bill, so Dave and I will probably play like, you know, nine or 10 sets and Keith and Jan will play the same number, and we'll do a collaborative thing as well. Probably
sounds
towards the end.
Yeah, that sounds great. Okay, finally, if you were to visit Rockport High School, my granddaughter is an aspiring musician, learning piano, guitar, violin, singing, and composing. If you were to talk to the music department kids at Rockport High School or any high school for that matter, would you have any advice to give them on how to? I mean, you're prolific and you're extremely talented and probably, without a doubt, you were a prodigy. But for those hanging on the edges there and wanting to make a go of it, what advice might you give them?
That would be really fun to go to Rockford High School. I love hanging out with teenagers, and I think I had a lot of good role models in my own life when I was a teenager. And I just think I would say, like, you know, find something that you really love doing and that that's unique about you. You know, you don't have to kind of be in this rat race of trying to like do the exact same thing that everybody else is doing. But like, I don't know. I always feel like staying true to like what the kind of music you want to play and being sincere, but also being like generous with your music and with your time. I would probably say something along those lines.
And the one thing I know that all musicians, I think, get out of being a musician is, and this is going to sound maybe egotistical, but it isn't, is the enjoyment that their own music provides. You can create music maybe in your basement and just enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. I think that's totally true. And then at the same time, I realized, especially during the pandemic, like how important the audience is.
Okay.
When I started like performing like online, which I didn't actually like.
Right.
That was like my least favorite part of the pandemic. Not that there's favorite parts of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. But I think I've been so much more appreciative like post-pandemic to interact with people, with like other humans, like, and to share that, and just realizing how important the audience, how important the people that run the venue, like how we're all kind of in this together, and to form this community of music.
I think it's fantastic. Is there anything that I haven't mentioned that you'd like to mention?
I don't think so. I'm just really excited to come. Maybe it'll be like a heat wave in November. We can all go swimming, you know, before.
Okay, well, good luck with that one. You don't live that far from Rockport, so you know.
I know.
Oh, God.
Wishful thinking.
Oh, my God. Hanukkah, it's been so delightful. I'm going to follow you from now on. I'm going to be one of your fans. I love your stuff. And thank you so much for talking with us today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, good luck. Talk to you later. Take care.
Okay.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
That is Hanukkah Castle, who will be performing at the Shailen Lou on November 15. You'll see all this stuff on the post with this interview. With MSO News Sports, I'm Rick Moore.